We're back. The Nordic Leaders podcast comes roaring back and goes global for season 5 with the theme of Fail Smart, Lessons in Leadership and Life.
We still have conversations that matter with extraordinary people based in the Nordics.
And we speak to experts and thought leaders globally from Abu Dhabi to Zimbabwe.
In our most popular pods, our guests open up about themselves, what they've learned along the way, and with the courage to talk about setbacks.
Indeed, the stuff that didn't quite work out how they intended, but how they came back stronger and wiser.
So, all the best elements of the Nordic Leaders podcast are still there, but there's a few extra questions about the ups and downs of life.
So join us, David, Nick and Stefano, as we explore failing smart with our hyper-successful guests.
We'd love to hear your thoughts, connect with any of us on LinkedIn, and 5-star ratings. They're okay if you like what you hear.
Indeed, 5-star ratings are okay. Let's get started with Fail Smart.
Hello, listeners. Today with us, we have a very special guest, Hal Gregersen. Hal is a senior lecturer in leadership and innovation at MIT's Sloan School of Management, a former executive director of the MIT Leadership Center, fellow at InnoSight, co-founder of the Innovators DNA Consulting Group, named after the book he co-authored with another immense thinker, Clayton Christensen. He has been ranked as number one leadership thinker in the world by Thinkers 50 for his work on inquisitive creativity and his most recent book, Questions Are the Answer. Of course, I could go on and on, but maybe it's better if I stop here, otherwise we'll never start. Thanks for giving us 1 hour of your time, Hal. Very welcome on the Nordic Leadership Podcast.
Thank you. It's delightful to be with all of you today.
The way how we like to open with everyone on this season, which is named Fail Smart, one question we wanted to ask is, what are the failure of failures that made you the person you are today?
The first one would be photography, frankly. Early on in my life, I just was absolutely smitten by photography. When I was 15 years old, got my first 35mm camera, ran outside, took a photograph, then took thousands of photographs, worked part-time jobs to buy a better and better camera. Finally, late in high school, ended up becoming a professional photographer, as doing weddings and portraits. I loved that. I had no intention of doing anything else for the rest of my life. And at the end of my undergraduate degree, which I was doing mostly to please my dad, and I chose the easiest major I could, business management, just to get through it. The last semester, I took a course on leadership. And it was intriguing, but during that semester, I was scheduled to take the wedding photographs of some really good friends. And my camera was broken, so I ended up borrowing another professional's, they call them medium format cameras. And at the end of the wedding, I was excited, took the film in to get developed, came back a couple of days to get the film and the prints. And when I saw it, I was devastated because none of the film was exposed.
No.
This is the day where you did not have all these backup images. It was a really close friend, and I'm like, oh, it was like somebody just put daggers inside of me everywhere. It hurt. And I'll never forget, this was the days of a rotary dial phone. And for the listeners who may not know what they are, you put your finger in a little dial, you moved it around, and it dialed the numbers. I can still remember the anxiety and the worry, putting my finger in that hole, dialing the number, and then telling my friend they had no photographs from their wedding day.
What was the feedback?
It was a real blank emptiness on the end of the other line. And then they extremely gracious about the situation, far more gracious than I would have been. But I was too young, too incapable, didn't know myself well enough to be able to work through that productively. And I literally, it's like the failure was so big, so public, so hurtful inside of my heart that I just could not re-engage with it. So over the course of the next half year, I gradually started walking away from it. And part of the walk away in the middle of that moment comes back to that last course on leadership in my university education as an undergraduate. And it was like, wow, this is the first course that's been really interesting, besides the photography course. And it was like, this is interesting stuff. I've always thought about this and paid attention to it and noticed it. And so it was that wonderful collision of moments in a person's life where something really devastating had happened professionally that, much to my surprise, created an emotional willingness to step away from one trajectory of a career and start walking down a very different one.
Do you think that if it wouldn't have been for that failure, you would still be doing?
I'm not sure, to be very honest. I realized that I did not want to be a wedding and portrait photographer when I was married and had a family. It was too many weekends, too much evening work. But I didn't know alternatives, and I didn't have any really good mentors to craft that path. I'm not sure. It's a great question, Stefano. Don't know.
How you mentioned your daughter recently got married. And congratulations. Congratulations to you and the family.
Thank you.
Did you do the photography?
No.
Thank goodness for that.
So this was really interesting. We're a blended family. My first wife passed away, and then I remarried, and this was about 20 years ago. And Susie, my wife now, she had 4 kids. I had 3. So we have 7 children. And now we have 6 partners or spouses, and then 12 or so grandchildren. So we have a clan going on here. And
wonderful.
And so when it came to the wedding, it was, I made a conscious, number one, I walked our daughter down the aisle, so I wasn't going to be taking photographs of myself walking down the aisle with my daughter. But then I sat down, and there were like 2 or 3 moments, because it was in our backyard, we lived near the ocean, it was a beautiful day. There were 2 or 3 moments that I'm like, dang, I wish I had my camera sitting underneath the chair here. But then I just kept saying to myself, just enjoy the moment. It's okay. And it was actually hard not to put that up in front of my face.
Yeah. Good that you did. You listened to yourself.
Yeah. No, and it was, the camera for me early on in life was a protective mechanism. I didn't know that then, but I know it now. In our high school, we had this yearbook staff, and there were photographers on it creating the yearbook. And the camera was a means by which I, as a teenager, could engage with the cool kids in a safe way, in some ways hidden behind that lens. And it also invited me into somebody else's space. And it's taken me a lifetime to start to figure out how to not be trapped by the camera, but how to let it be a, not a protective mechanism, but a deeply exploratory mechanism.
Interesting. But you still do take photographs, do you?
Yeah, just this morning. I woke up. I got up about 4:30, and unlike Finland, where the sun is always up in the summertime, we actually have the sun come up here. And I didn't intend to take photographs this morning, but there was this stunning sunrise, fishing boats going out onto the ocean, birds everywhere. And it's a way by which I step back, take a moment, experience the beauty of this world. I have an eye for hidden wholeness. I'm trying to find opposites in the photographs I take, light and dark, complexity, contrast, those sorts of things.
So it sounds like a very good companion these days, your camera, as opposed to a protective.
Actually, yes. And I did not expect to be able to say yes with that kind of energy, Nick, 10 years ago. When I married Susie about 20 years ago, she looked at my photographs from when I was younger. She's like, why don't you take photographs anymore? And I told her the story I told you. And then she's like, you need to buy a camera again. And so I finally, after a year of listening to her, ordered a camera. And then I did not open the box for a month when it came. That speaks to you about how that hurt from the failure was still holding on, and I was unaware of it. So then I started taking photographs, and then it was roughly 6 or 7 years ago, I realized it is time to do what I've always wanted to do, and that is, how can I more fully integrate these 2 courses of my life into something that has that own hidden wholeness? My wife is a sculptor, and she was doing a sculpting workshop in Santa Fe, New Mexico. I was bored, and so I looked up Santa Fe workshops to see, is there something I can do for a couple of days here? It's a photographic workshops place. And I ended up meeting Reid Callinan, the director of the Santa Fe Photographic Workshops, trying to ask him for 10 minutes, what workshop should I take? 10 minutes turned into 3 hours. And Reid at the end of it was like, Hal, you really need to be giving a workshop because you want to explore this intersection of leadership, innovation, inquiry, and photography. Let me think about it, and I'll introduce you to somebody. And that somebody was Sam Abel. He'd been a National Geographic photographer for 30 years. And Sam, if you've never seen his work, it's stunning. So Sam and I then started collaborating together. And at MIT, we built a workshop with Santa Fe Photographic Workshops at MIT around leadership and the lens. And that journey has led me now to realize that so much of what I taught and still teach about leadership, innovation, the power of questions, it literally has analogs to the world of photography. And one informs the other.
Cool. If I remember the quote correctly, you said somewhere or sometime that the gift of inquisitive creativity is something we are all born with. And you think that is something that we can sustain. But so when do we lose that kind of inquisitive creativity and how we can sustain?
All of us are born curious. We ask tons of questions as soon as we're capable of articulating words coming out of our mouths. And even before their words, we're still asking questions non-verbally. But the point is, you watch any four-year-old on planet Earth, four-year-olds are constantly asking questions of the world around them. Constantly. And this is the funny part. It's like no matter what culture we're in, what I just said is true. And then it's like, okay, if we were all asking questions when we were 4 years old, why don't we do that today? That's the issue for me. What happened between 4 and 24 and 44 and 64 and 84? What was going on there? And so one of the things we do in our workshops and that I do at MIT and beyond is we do what we call a question journey. So imagine the three of you taking a few moments to step back and think about how did authority figures respond to your tough, challenging questions at different stages of your life? For example, at home, how did they respond to it? What about your school when you were roughly 5 to 17-ish years old? What about university or technical training? What about your first professional role? What about your first managerial role? What about right now? And what we've discovered is that if you look at somebody like Arik Gaudish, who's the chairman of Bain Consulting Group, she grew up in Israel. Her parents were very supportive of her asking questions. At school, whenever the teacher said, does anybody have questions? Arik would raise her hand all the time with two or three questions. When Arik was 12 or 13 years old, in her little mini yearbook from that age of school, one of her teachers wrote, Arit always asked those two or three questions. So she had teacher support on this. And then she, out of her university education, she gets hired by Bain Consulting. And this is 30 plus years ago. She's sent as a young female consultant to Japan to work in the steel industry. So just get that wrapped around your head. But it's just classic Arit. It's just like she walks into the steel factories. Why are we doing this? Why are we doing this? Why are we doing that? Why are we doing this? And all of those questions, we're just trying to figure out what's working, what's not, and why. And at the end of it, I think it was something like 300 SKUs in their steel products. They distilled down to a handful and became profitable. But it was Arit asking question after question. And so the point I'm trying to say here, she happened to be a positive example. In my world, my first grade report card was basically, he annoys people because he does things like asking questions and he's exploring the world and being curious and not sitting in his chair. And I remember Mrs. Nielsen, my teacher, constantly trying to shove me down in my chair and shut down the exploration. And at home, my parents, bless their hearts, my father was a master with anything mechanical. If he didn't have the part for his car, he could make it. If he didn't have the tool to put the car on, he could fix it. But he was also the center of our world. And in today's words, it was probably be emotionally abusive and sometimes physically. And in that kind of unpredictable, fearful world, as a kid, you grow up realizing you better be very careful about what you say and what you do around that authority figure. And so, for the most part, questions were completely off the map when I was growing up at home, at least ones that challenged anything that my father was doing or thinking. You just didn't do that. But then, in college, you know, that last teacher I told us about at the beginning, Joe Bentley, he was one of those teachers who, like, really fostered inquiry. And then in graduate school, a lifetime friend, Bonner Ritchie, he changed my life with inquiry because he was just so curious and demanding of intellectual rigor and inquiry in the work we did with him in classes. So the reason that question journey can be so productive is the following. Very few people have taken even 20 minutes to systematically think through how has the world responded to my fearless questions over the course of my life. But we've found that when people do take that time to step back and reflect on how the world around them responds to tough, challenging questions, theirs, it can help them know how to better pose those fearless questions in the moment. To this day, I have to be consciously aware of what I do when I'm around authority figures. Because I still have that learned practice of being a four-year-old in my home, having it all shut down and being really careful. And I just have to learn to say to myself, context, context, this is not home, you are not four, you've grown up a little bit more, you can behave differently here, it's okay.
Yeah. So it's all about the feedback that you receive from the environment you're born in and raised in. And so how can we, in business or at home, be more supportive of our kids, of our people that work with us, asking those questions, being curious?
Whether it's me in my home with my wife, with our children, with our grandchildren, or me at work with the team that's around me, or me in my community and my neighborhood, the way in which the starting point for productive, fearless inquiry for me is having a challenge or opportunity that is so interesting that we have to do something about it. So the starting point for questioning is really, are we showing up at work or at home looking for a way to make that world better for somebody? And that's what I'm calling a challenge or opportunity. It's basically, I'm saying to myself, the status quo is maybe okay, but it's not going to be in the future, and how could we make it better? So what challenge would be really interesting to be working on here and now? And if my home or my workplace shuts down my ability to find challenges that matter and do something about it, I've effectively shut down that person's power of inquiry. If I'm not showing up to solve a challenge, I'm not going to be asking any questions. I'll be doing my job, going through the motions. It's that whole stuff. So the starting point, Stefano, is we're challenge-driven. We call it at MIT challenge-driven leadership. That's how we show up. And ideally, especially if we're in a leadership role, again, in any context, home, community, or work, it's like the challenge darn well better be bigger than we are. It's not about us. It's some challenge that would require a set of other people who have complementary skills, perspective, background, experience to help pull this off. Those are the fun challenges. So that, yeah, to me, that's absolutely the start. That's the starting point. And you're all coaches and you're all consultants and you're all leaders, all three of you. And it's, think of your work. You wander in an organization, and if people can't find and solve challenges in their everyday work, questioning, the power of questioning, is effectively shut down. Done.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It's how about we show up. David, what have you heard?
Lots of fascinating things. I'd like to hear a bit more about the question journey. I'd like to hear a bit more about what Howell has learned about how to better pose fearless questions in the moment. You said we're leadership coaches, and I was wrapping up a program last week and asked people, what are your key takeaways? And many people said, ask more questions and listen more. Those are my key takeaways from this quite lengthy journey that we've been on, and they were actually quite happy with that. So this comes up a lot. And then I ask them, and sometimes it comes up early in the journey, I ask them, well, what's getting in the way? What is it that's holding you back? And sometimes this is what they say. It's not easy. I don't know how to do this, challenging questions in the right way. So maybe that's what I would be interested to hear next, is what kind of tips you have and what you've learned about how better to pose those fearless questions.
So again, for me, David, the starting point for posing fearless questions is actually not only what is the challenge I care about, but let's imagine the three of you are on my team. If I don't know what challenge you, David, care about, and Nick, what challenge you care about, and Stefano, what challenge you care about, then I'm not going to be able to pose a fearless question to you without you becoming defensive.
Yeah.
If you don't feel like I fully understand what your situation is, what you're wrestling with, what your challenge is, if you don't feel that I get it, then if I pose a fearless question, tough question to you, it's not going to go anywhere.
Yeah.
And so the starting point for me for this process of really engaging the superpower of questioning is stepping back, starting with what's my challenge, what's yours, and think that we, as coaches, the notion of 360-degree feedback. Sure. In this case, it would be, what's my 360-degree viewpoint on the challenges of the people around?
So before I ask the challenging questions, I get out there, and I'm just curious about you. What are you working on? What's happening in you? What are your drivers? What are your motivations? What's holding you back at the moment? I'm just curious about your situation.
And then, exactly.
Then I can get to the more kind of challenging questions. Is that what I'm hearing?
Yeah, and then it comes from a space of, you're in this with me, not against me, because you've invested enough time and energy to know what my honest challenge is. And that's a journey in and of itself. But once we get to that space, then it's, okay, let's pose some fearless questions. And that could naturally occur because we've literally created this space, this psychologically safe space, where I, Hal Gregersen, and or you, any one of you, can be wrong instead of, we can be uncomfortable and surprised emotionally instead of the opposite, and we can be reflectively quiet instead of nonstop talking, trying to fill this space with information because we're anxious about things we don't know we don't know.
I'm just curious, if I may ask a follow-up question, is this just our Western education systems where we are just pushed all the time to try to close things down, to try to find answers? Here in Finland, for example, it's very popular to be trained as an engineer, and engineers are always looking to fix things, narrow things down, find the answers, rather than the inquisitive process of opening things up and looking for possibilities. How do you see it in MIT? Do you see some cultural factors around
that? That notion of challenge-driven leadership actually came from us studying MIT alumni and what kind of quote-unquote leaders come out of MIT. And number one, they don't like the word leadership. They associate that word with status quo operations, with process orientation, with position and power and those sorts of things. And they're like, now give that to somebody else. I just want to find a big challenge and solve it. And so with that challenge-driven mentality, at least my experience is, engineers are actually pretty inquisitive, the good ones, and they ask really great questions about the challenges they care about. Now, their Achilles heel, the downside can be sometimes they can be so challenge-focused that they're unaware of what other people's feelings are around them. And so one of the of MIT is Dr. Lisa Su, who's the CEO of AMD, one of the big semiconductor makers in the world. And when she was young, somebody told her, Lisa, as a young engineer, run towards problems. She did. They were technical ones. When she became a manager, one of her managers said to her, Lisa, do you talk to your people? And she's like, yes, of course I talk to my people. It's that challenge-driven mindset. We're trying to solve problems. And then her boss said, like, how often do you talk with your people? All the time. Then her boss said, "Do you ever ask them how they feel?" And she said, in her mind, I thought, that is like the most useless question ever to be asking. Seriously. And her response was, like, why would I ask them how they feel? I don't want anybody asking me how I feel, so why should I ask them how they feel? And her boss's response was, "Lisa, if you're going to make progress in this world, it's not only about challenges from a technical perspective, but you've got to pull in that emotional side to be able to move it forward." And so that's where that emotional sensitivity has got to be combined with the technical challenge-driven orientation in order for this stuff to work.
Thank you.
Yeah, I kind of, this discussion kind of reminds me of that we had the other day, David, when I told you that I have the feeling that very few people in the world have experienced the feeling of being listened to as employers. Yeah. Really, like having someone that asks you a question and is genuinely interested in hearing the answer.
We need the rational and the emotional engagement.
We really do. And then it's okay, given that I've got this, I need to be willing to put myself in a situation. And I meant this from the research I did around questions are the answer. I interviewed 200 of the world's best, most innovative leaders and distilled down 3 million words of transcripts to what are the conditions they create where they ask those tough, fearless questions that create value. They make an impact. And number one, they put themselves in situations where they can become intellectually wrong. And that's because they are very aware that they have mental maps of the world. The maps are never right, quote unquote, and they're always trying to figure out which parts of their maps are off. So it's like, how can I get myself in a situation where I am intellectually wrong? The second part is, how can I put myself in a situation where I'm emotionally surprised to the extreme? The negative version of that is discomfort, uncomfortable. The positive is just ecstatic. That's the coolest thing on planet Earth. But it's two ends of the distribution. Emotionally, how do I get myself in those situations? And finally, how do I create more reflective, quiet space in a world that is all about action and words and talking? And if I can't create those three conditions, it's highly unlikely I will ask myself those kinds of tough questions that move things forward. And if I don't create those conditions for the people around me, they're doomed as well. So this is where it was probably last year I started realizing that Amy Edmondson's work on psychological safety was this perfect dovetail, much to my surprise, with the work that I do. It's a method I use that creates these conditions of being wrong, uncomfortable, and reflectively quiet. And that method I discovered 20 years ago, which is imagine yourself stuck on some issue. Individually, as a team, an organization, a community, I don't care what level or layer, but you're stuck. And by definition, when we're stuck, we don't have the answer, and we have to be asking different questions. The reason we're stuck is we're asking the wrong questions. And when we get stuck, that's an intellectual stuckness, we're usually at an emotional, more negative space. And in that moment, the best thing to do is take a moment of reflective quiet, stop, maybe take a breath, breathe, and then engage in what I call a question burst, which is ask nothing but questions for a defined period of time about whatever that challenge is that you're confronted with and stuck on. You can do this. We can do this as individuals. We don't need anybody around us. We can do it in pairs where we're just talking to somebody else. We can do it in small groups. And we can do it beyond that. But the point is, we're stuck on a challenge that we care about. And then we set a timer. 1 to 4 minutes. Usually 2 to 4 minutes is better. And I know from the data that if we don't answer any of our questions and we don't explain why we're asking any of our questions, if we just ask questions, the metric is 5 questions per minute. We'll get about 5 questions per minute. if we're following the rules.
Sorry if I ask, but if we are more than just one, do we have to write them down? Do we have to just pick them up? How do you collect the questions?
So imagine David, Nick, and Eustefano were doing this together. I wouldn't do it with more than three people in the process I'm describing. Let's pretend all three of you identified a challenge you care about. David, you're first. We set a timer for 2 minutes. You explain to Nick and Stefano, this is the essence of my challenge. If you spend more than 2 minutes explaining the challenge, you probably will tell them enough information that they'll be as stuck as you are. So it's just 2 minutes, make it short, make it focused. Then David would have his computer, his pad, his paper and pencil in front of him, and he would write down all of the questions that the three of you can generate about his challenge. I'd number them to try to get that 5 questions per minute. Write them down word for word, because David, if you change their questions, the words, you've changed their question. And if they're going too fast, ask them to slow down. Timer now goes off, 4 minutes, done. If you did it right, you probably have close to 20 questions. Boom. Then it's Nick's turn. 2 minutes, explain your challenge. Now Nick writes down for 4 minutes after that, nothing but questions. Ditto for Stefano. At the end of that process, 85% of the time, you will be emotionally in a more positive place. You will have reframed your challenge. You will have been asked or ask at least one question that causes you to feel uncomfortable. And you'll have the questions will have created at least one new idea to help you make progress on the challenge. That 85% outcome happens if we do it alone. It happens if we do it with other people. What's going on? That's interesting. You're all coaches. You could do it I've done it in coaching sessions. You know where you're stuck in that moment? Let's just take a minute here.
Cool.
Yeah, actually, it's easy for us because
because
the whole thing about coaching is about learning to ask questions. So that we can do.
Yeah, and I have a challenge as well.
Tell us.
Yeah, and we do. And so this is when I realized that doing this process is exactly what Amy Edmondson is recommending people do to build psychological safety. And that is, the first part is you set the stage. You frame the work. Well, when David shares with Nick and Stefano his challenge, he's framing the work. And he's also signaling the next part on inviting participation. He's demonstrating situational humility. He's basically saying, guess what? I don't have the answer to this issue. I need your help. That's what Amy talks about. Demonstrate situational humility. Then it's like practice inquiry and listening. And this process of questions only forces us to listen. When what we want to do is fill in the dead space with answers and justifications. But it forces us to shut that down. And Amy suggests we have a structure and process to listen and ask. And that's exactly what this question burst process is. It has rules. It's got structure. No answers, no explanations, a defined period of time, and so on. And then it's, okay, we're done with that. Whew. Amy's then is, we'll respond productively by first thanking each other. David, Nick, and Stefano thank each other for the questions because you made some progress. And then it's, no, we're not asking questions for questioning's sake. We're like, we're going to do something about these questions. So I'd invite you to take a minute, look through those questions, find one or two that are, I call them call to action questions. Ones that compel you to get out into the world, to see with your eyes, watch things, talk and listen to people, experiment in the spirit of failure, experiment and try something to get some data back, to start getting some information to get answers to your question. And that is a process by which everything I just said was the question burst process. But if you look in Amy's book, The Fearless Organization, it's the exact way she describes for leaders to build psychological safety. And what I've watched in people who do this is they not only make progress on their challenge, but they also have built deeper trust and deeper psychological safety in the process.
Win-win.
Yeah, no, exactly.
Hal, thank you for describing that incredibly powerful process. I just wondered whether David and Stefano had any questions about the process that Hal's just described. I've got a question for Hal, which is probably a little bit different.
It was very clear to me.
It was. And it's amazing, Hal, that we prepared this script beforehand, and we most of the questions on it we haven't actually asked you, but you've answered them. So I don't know what was going on there, but I think, Nick, you could go with your question. The thing that I'm curious about with Hal is what we should be asking you. If you've answered all of our questions without asking, even answering them, maybe our questions are a little bit predictable. If you were in our shoes, what should we be asking you? A little bit of coaching,
well,
jiu-jitsu,
I mean,
going on there.
No, there are two angles that I would respond to that with. One would be any leader with gray matter inside of their skull knows that questions matter, right? Know that this power of inquiry is important. Mm. But so many leaders don't know how to ask better questions and do not have an awareness of their own approach to this power of inquiry. So another tool that I strongly recommend to people is just taking a moment, literally, taking a moment to, for 24 hours, try to write down all the questions you have that you ask other people, that you ask yourself in your own head, that other people ask you. And when you do that, at the end of that 24 hours, step back and look for patterns. What's going on here? One of the patterns is, what's your question to answer ratio? Are you an ask or a tell? That's another important thing to be aware of. Another thing is, what's the focus of your question? Is it descriptive with what, how, who, when, where, why sorts of stuff? Or is it prescriptive? What if, how might, why not, how else? And a lot of leaders are just hyper-focused on, what do we do? How do we do it? What do we do? How do we do it? What do we do? How do we do it? Which gets things done, but it might be the wrong things to be doing. And then the other part is this whole fearless questioning piece. How do people respond to fearless questions? How do you? How do they? What's going on? The other part then just becomes, what question, especially in this pandemic, post-pandemic, hybrid, digitally transforming world, it's like, what questions give you energy and which ones are taking it away? And in a coaching world, this is really important. I mentioned earlier on growing up in a complex household, and I often ask two questions. How will I get it all done, and will I ever measure up? And that's what happens when you're a little four-year-old who has no clue about predictability around them with one of the parents. Is, will I ever get it all done, and will I ever measure up? Those are energy-taking questions when you're not 4 years old. They were very functional and valuable as a four-year-old, but not now. And so to me, it's instead of like, how can I get it all done? I'm much better off saying, what can I do right now to make progress on this challenge or project? And whenever I change that question, I actually get more energy. So it's being aware of those energy giving, energy taking. The other part, and this is especially relevant to 2022 and beyond, is we are in the middle of an AI machine learning explosion. This happened, we could go into a long story about this, but the essence of it is, 10 years ago, when AlexNet won a competition, it was 10 years ago, literally, won a competition that their computer and algorithm could correctly identify cats and dogs and monkeys and people faster than any other algorithm and computer in the world. And they did it because they built a computer with GPUs, not CPUs. That launched machine learning to a completely different level. We now see that all around us. If I were to have asked leaders 10 years ago, how does your engagement with machine learning influence your questions? Most leaders would have looked at me like, you are cuckoo, buddy. But come to today, I've asked those questions regularly now around the world, and at least half of the leaders are cognitively aware that their engagement with AI is changing their questions. The velocity is going up. They're asking more questions because machine learning is exceptional at surfacing patterns we humans can't see. It generates a different variety of questions. And if we are deeply engaged with the challenge, we can get to something novel and unique that creates really great value. And so they're finding that if you're engaged deeper with that machine learning artificial intelligence, it actually is causing you to be a little more wrong, a little more uncomfortable, a little more reflectively quiet, and to be asking questions faster, more differently, and uniquely. And so I don't think a lot of people actually are aware of that when they reflect on their whole, this questioning stuff work they're doing. And the other piece is, if we do that audit, it's, did anybody say in that 24 hours, do you have any great questions? Or great question, Nick, that's a great question you just asked me. You know, what makes a great question? And I'm doing some really fun work with Pia Lorentzen, who's the founder of a company in Denmark called Quest. And we've been collaborating on some things. We're writing a great question report. One of the elements of a great question is that the word leader is not in it. I'm dead serious.
Yeah.
This is from a big database they've got of conversations about challenges in organizations. And people rarely say, that's a great question, if the word leader is in the question.
And one of the elements of great podcasts is that the word leader is not in the title. So from the Nordic Leaders podcast, I think I should hand over to Nick now. But thank you for those answers, Hal. They were fabulous. I think we could make a whole episode out of those. But Nick, sorry, I didn't mean to jump in ahead of you there.
No, not at all. Not at all, David. Anyway. Thank you for saying that, though. It was fascinating listening to that, the AI question as well. It's amazing, isn't it? And I've been just listening, Hal, so I forgot the question I was going to ask. But you mentioned something about your four-year-old self a few moments back. And yeah. I wondered, what's it like being Hal Gregersen today?
It's an ongoing journey, Nick. Being Hal Gregersen is an ongoing journey. One of my close professional and personal friends is Roger Lehman, who co-founded the Coaching and Consulting for Change program at INSEAD there in France and teaching it around the world. And what I've learned is that we all, whether we know it or not, we are making our way through mortality with what I call keystone and shadow questions. And I mentioned some of my shadow questions earlier. Will I ever measure up? Will I ever get everything all done? That kind of stuff. Those are shadow questions. And at one point about a decade ago, I finally realized that they were there, that they were destructive. And I worked for 2 or 3 years to try to get rid of them. And in the process of that, I finally realized you don't. Then Roger helped me learn how to befriend the shadow. It's like, You're not going to get rid of it, Hal. It will always be part of you, but befriend it. Be aware of it. Be aware that, you know, that how will I ever measure up question is popping back again. Befriend it. Say, thanks for reminding me. That helped when I was 4, but it's not helpful at 54. Thank you. And so there's that notion of befriending it. And that's been really important for the last 3 years. Being Hal in 2020 was depression, seriously. I had mild to moderate depression. We had a grandchild who was born and passed away, and we never held him in our arms because we couldn't comfortably travel in the midst of COVID. I had 2 close friends pass away in 2020. We had one of our beloved pets pass away. And it was just a year of loss and devastation. And then 2021, I would describe in Adam Grant's language of languishing. trying to get out of that. And 2022 has been much more explanation with a foundation layer of depression still trying to grab and languishing still trying to get its little tentacles holding on. But the good news is I feel like I understand what's going on. I feel more capable of being able to say thank you, but no thanks to that shadow work and move more into that space of the keystone work, which for me is really around how might I inspire others to see the dark, the shadow, to seek the light, the keystone, and to embrace the hidden wholeness. Thomas Merton was a philosopher, and that was his phrase, in all living things, there is a hidden wholeness. And I'm still learning how to do that embracing, Nick. And it's well worth the journey because it's a ton better than living one half of that life, either all dark or whatever.
Thank you. Thank you for showing up today, answering all of our questions. And thank you for what you just said. We all sense and feel those feelings and thoughts. Thank you for your answer. I really appreciate it.
No, Nick, thank you. And we have lived through a few years with enormous losses. And all of us have, in one form or another. And I think one of the steps to asking better questions is just being aware that people are living with a lot of loss. That's the starting point. And just acknowledging that and sharing and talking about it, and but not necessarily dwelling on it, but at least being aware of it.
Yeah.
I love a quote by Elie Wiesel that feels like this moment right now, Nick, with us. And he said, in the word question, there's a beautiful word, quest. I love that word. But then the follow-up is even better. And this reminds me of the three of you, truthfully. The follow-up is the following. We are all partners in a quest. You are my question, and I am yours. And then there is dialogue, which is what we were just doing. And then his final two lines, the moment we have answers, there is no dialogue. Questions unite people, answers divide. We are moving, whether we like it or not, into an increasingly uncertain world. We think we're dealing with uncertainty now. I hate to tell us, folks, but it's likely to get more challenging. Because we're living in an exponential age where pandemics and technology and global climate change are all exponential in nature, which means they're unpredictable in terms of their impact, positive and negative. And these things are explosive. So imagine your coaching work 10 years from now. Technology itself is going to change our coaching work 10 times, tenfold. What will that look like? And in 15 years, it will change it 100-fold. Get your head around that. And as we are all navigating through this increasingly uncertain terrain, we all need those moments, Nick, where it's like, what's it like to be Nick? What's it like to be Stefano? What's it like to be David? What's it like to be Hal here and now?
Yeah, these reflection moments are just so important. We need to stop and think, okay, what's next? What can I do? Well, and what questions should I be asking?
Yeah, it's funny that you should mention that because I know what I'm going to do next. After this podcast, I'm going to write down all the questions that people have been asking me recently and look for the patterns. That's my takeaway from today.
Cool.
Actually, I have a lot of takeaways.
Good homework, David. No, good homework.
Yeah, I have a bit of a preconceived idea what that pattern might be, but I'm going to look for it. Thank you.
We should all be doing that, and everyone listening to this should be doing that as well.
Yeah.
You did.
What questions have you been asked?
It's a powerful exercise, and it's one that can be done not only individually, but imagine doing it as a team for the next three meetings where somebody's, your job is just to write down all the questions we're asking each other. And let's take some time at the end of that to explore them. Are they being helpful or not?
Fascinating idea. Absolutely fascinating. And another big ka-ching for me in our discussion was when I mentioned that we, as coaches, we often get feedback that asking more questions is the output from a development program. The other thing that people often talk about is getting more ideas around energy management and what energizes you, where you leak energy. Mm-hmm. And the ka-ching moment was to put the two things together, is what questions mm-hmm. are mm-hmm. energizing you and what questions are draining you.
Or yeah, leaking well energy. Done. Totally. Yeah. And that's where sometime today, all four of us are going to be stuck on something. And it was just a reminder, okay, this is pulling it. This is like taking a lot of watts out of the light bulb here. I'm going to stop. Just step back for a second, set a timer, generate as many questions as I can, and boom. It's like hitting the reset button on your, what are those buttons called in your house? The breaker, the electrical breaker, switching those things on and off. Yeah, the circuit breaker, exactly.
Cool. Wow.
Hal, yeah, this was fantastic.
Yeah.
Thanks for all of that. I've been mesmerized by listening to you in the last. So thank you very much, really.
Thanks, Hal.
So great. Incredible.
Thank you for your generosity. Are the couple still married that you screwed up the photographs with?
Lovely way of putting that question, thank you.
They are, yeah. Possibly because of your intervention there. They brought them closer together at the beginning.
Yeah, I love your optimism, but I'm not exactly sure that was the case. Thanks to all of you. And it's been a marvelous excursion for me. It's been a great journey. I've learned some good things here. Okay?
Okay, thanks.
Okay, thanks.
Cheers. Good. You have a great day.
Thank you.
Enjoy the rest of your
okay.
day.
Okay, have a great
Take
day.
Care.
Cheers.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Hey listener, it's Stefano here. Since you got until here, we think that you might like the podcast. It would mean so much if you could leave us a 5-star review and share this with as many of your friends as possible. This will help us be discovered and spread the news. Can you just take 5 minutes and do that for us? Thank you.